I think we've reached the point where we should call the proceedings to order. Welcome, and thank you all for attending this conference on the Supreme Court case selection process, sponsored by the Yale Law School Supreme Court Clinic and the Yale Law Journal Online. I'm Charles Rothfeld of Mayor Brown and the Yale Clinic. And before we get started, I'd just like to briefly thank three people who have done most of the real work in putting this conference together. Meredith Berger of the Yale Law School staff, Kathleen Clausen and Jennifer Harris, who were students at Yale, participants in the clinic last year, and they've each devoted countless hours to actually organizing this and getting it going. So they are the reason that we're here this morning. And again, a thousand thanks to Meredith, Kathleen, and Jen. We're here to talk about a question that has been a source of endless fascination for people who are followers of the court. Is it making a hash of one of its most important functions, the function of deciding what cases to decide? When I was in the Solicitor General's office 25 years ago, the court decided exactly twice as many cases each year as it's deciding today. And we would sometimes complain that the court was doing too much. And that's not a complaint that you hear much nowadays about the court. But the question of how the court got to this point, and how its docket has shrunk so much, is something which has been the subject of considerable attention from a lot of people, certainly from those of us who file cert petitions for a living. But the focus on the numbers and the change in the nature of the court's docket should not obscure other related and equally significant questions. Is the court deciding the right cases or the right kinds of cases? Is its case selection process the right one? Is there a way in which that process can be improved? Should it be changed? And to help address, talk about these questions, we have assembled a group of some of the most close students of the Supreme Court in the nation today. We have some of the leading and most successful practitioners before the court. We have academics who have written some of the most insightful analyses of what the court is up to. We have the Dean of the Supreme Court Press. And we are fortunate to have Judge Wilkinson of the Fourth Circuit, who may have a unique perspective on whether the court is taking the right cases from the courts of appeals. And to focus the discussion, we have divided these esteemed speakers into three panels. The first, which is before you now, is moderated by Linda Greenhouse, for a longtime Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, who has now found her true calling as a professor at Yale Law School. This panel will address the state of the court's docket and how it got to where it is now. Second panel, which will be moderated by Tom Merrill, former Deputy Solicitor General of the United States and now a professor at Yale, will look at the question of whether the court is deciding the right cases and whether its case selection process is leading it to make the right kinds of decisions. The third panel, which will be moderated by Andy Pincus of Mayor Brown, also of the Yale Clinic, is going to look to the future and whether there are ways in which the case selection process can be improved. And I hope that each of these panels will leave ample time for members of the audience to participate with questions and comments. And if the panels come to some decisive and definitive resolution, we will provide that to the Chief Justice. And since we have a lot of important points to cover, let me turn it over without further ado to Linda and the first panel.
Okay, Charles, thank you. And I just want to second what Charles said. There is collected in this room, on this panel, but in this room, just an amazing amount of Supreme Court expertise. And we're going to be talking about things that I think if we all found ourselves stranded on a desert island, we might choose to talk about anyway. So, without much introduction, people are going to speak for five or so minutes giving their take on, we all know what's happened, but their take on why the incredible shrinking docket has shrunk to half of what it was when I started covering the court. People have different theories and they will present them, and then we'll have a bit of conversation here. And if we have time before 10 past 10, when we have to close to move on to the more, the use the buzzword at Yale Law School, normative part of our program, we'll conclude. So we're going to start, we're going to go in the order in which people are sitting, and start with David Strass, who has a very interesting previously undisclosed theory that he's putting forth here for the first time about why we see what's happening.
Thank you, Linda. I've actually written a couple of papers in this area, the most recent one being, I think, quite interesting, because this paper deals with a set of documents that really we haven't spent a lot of time with, which is the Blackmun papers, at least, which covers the period from 1991 to 1993 when we saw the greatest drop in the Supreme Court's plenary docket. The Marshall papers, the Brennan papers, none of those papers went up through the 93 term. And so this is the first time we've had a chance to take a look at the way things have changed between 1991 and 1993, when the plenary docket really fell off a cliff. I mean, I think it was the greatest single decline since 1952, single term decline. There's various hypotheses. We've got the cert pool, which I've written about previously. There's SG, the drop in SG petitions. There's the repeal of mandatory appellate jurisdiction. There's homogeneity in the Court of Appeals. One thing to note is it's a very difficult empirical problem to solve. You've got potential collinearity between a lot of these variables, meaning that it's hard to identify a single determinant of why the plenary docket declined. But nonetheless, I'm going to try to make an attempt to enlighten some of these things during my presentation today. There were five replacements on the court between 1986 and 1993, the time period in which I focus on in the paper. You had Scalia essentially for Berger, because Rehnquist was elevated to the chief justiceship, Kennedy for Powell, Souter for Brennan, Thomas for Marshall, and Ginsburg for White. What's fascinating is that each and every one of these replacements, the new justice sitting on the court was more stingy with grant votes and joined three votes, which I treat in the paper as the equivalent of a grant, than their predecessor. All five fall under this category. So, and in fact, in figure four in the paper, one of the interesting things is there's a differential of about 50 votes in favor of certiorari per term for these new justices collectively. So that's a phenomenal drop when Justice White, for example, was the most prodigious with his grant votes. He voted to grant cert at about 220 or 230 times per term, about twice that of any other member of the court. And when he left and was replaced by Justice Ginsburg, who voted to grant cert about 63 times during the 93 term, obviously that had a phenomenal impact on the plenary docket. So I think the personnel changes, in addition to some of the other hypotheses, have had a really great impact on the size of the plenary docket. Just to give you some further background in terms of the statistics, three personnel changes were particularly significant. I've already talked about Ginsburg and White. I think by far that's the most significant. Again, Ginsburg voted to grant cert at about 29% the rate of her predecessor, Justice White. Souter voted to grant cert 83 times per term on average. Brennan, whom he replaced, voted to grant cert 129 times per term on average. Justice Thomas, for whom I clerked, voted to grant cert during this period 72 times per term. Justice Marshall, whom he replaced, voted to grant cert an average of 125 times per term. What's fascinating about this accounts for about a 250 vote differential that during this period, which means that between 1990 and by the time 1993 rolled around, it was as if the court were operating with seven members of the court. In other words, 250 votes were gone in terms of grants for certiorari, the equivalent of two members of the court, because the average during the period was about 120 grants per term. It's a difficult thing to measure, but one of the things that's interesting about this in terms of these numbers is most of the hypotheses that have been put forward, fewer SG petitions, greater homogeneity on the courts of appeal, all of those should operate equally on both the pre-1986 justices and on the ones that were appointed between 1986 and 1993. But they don't. I mean, we know that they don't, that the objective data is there. And so one of the things that needs to happen going forward is to figure out why that's happening. One account is that there's personnel changes, but we do see that general drop in all justices between 91 and 93. So there are some other factors that are also operating on the justices. But I do think it's a really interesting issue, and obviously I do think that these personnel changes have had an impact on the court. Now, what What accounts for where the docket is today? I don't know the answer to that because we don't have the data, but at least between 86 and 93, my research shows that it's some combination of the cert pool, I think, and changes in personnel. Thanks.
That David's paper and the other papers that are going to be mentioned here, not everybody has a written paper, but I think they're all available outside, as is the basic document for this conference, the paper written by two students, which lists of, crunches 14 or 15 hypotheses about the shrinking docket. Let me turn next to Roy Englert, who's a very distinguished Supreme Court practitioner and former member of the SG's office. Roy, what's your theory?
Well, I think many of the hypotheses that have been put forward probably have some truth in them. But the one I want to focus on that I think is a large part of the problem, and I do call it a problem, is the cert pool and the behavior of the law clerks in recommending grants and denials. I call it a problem partly for reasons of bias. Every lawyer in private practice thinks that some of his petitions that should have been granted were denied. And so we always have our hearts set on certain grants, tell our clients cases have a good chance, and then have to explain that they've been denied. But there are a lot of petitions out there that look like possible grants that get denied, and so I don't see the decline in the docket as just a neutral statistical fact. I do see it as a problem. The best empirical work that has been done on the cert pool was done by the man sitting to my right, David Strauss, and it's published in a book review in the Texas Law Review in 2007. Again, using the Blackmun papers, David went to four terms of the court and examined each pool memo and the grants and denials to see what the relationships were, and his analysis covers a lot of factors, but I want to focus on just one statistic he came up with, which is there is just an extraordinarily high correlation between the number of grants recommended by the pool and the number of actual grants by the justices. It doesn't mean that the numbers are the same. The pool consistently recommends fewer grants than the justices end up making, and it doesn't mean that they're the same cases, but the correlation is remarkably constant across terms, suggesting that either the low number of grants recommended by the pool is causing the low number of actual grants, or that causation runs in the other direction, that the justices are somehow telling the law clerks, we want fewer grants, and the law clerks are responding by recommending fewer grants. I was at a talk by Sam Alito, Justice Alito, moderated by Carter Phillips about 2 years ago at the end of his first full term on the court. And the question of why is the number of grants going down came up. Justice Alito took the position in that talk, and I think he said the same thing at Pepperdine later, that the justices are not discouraging the clerks from recommending grants, that if anything, he believed that the criteria he was applying and his colleagues were applying were more generous than had been applied during his days in the SG's office when he was writing cert petitions rather than voting whether to grant or deny. And he said that for reasons that mystify him, the grantable cases just aren't there. Now, I take it that Justice Alito was telling the truth. I don't think he was, I don't think the hypothesis that he was lying is one worth exploring. But that leaves open two possibilities. One is that the cases really aren't there for whatever reason, which would have to be explained by some hypothesis we haven't gotten to. The other is that the justices are not being made aware of the cases that they should be granting, and that somehow cases that should be granted are slipping through their cracks, so that even someone like Justice Alito can say, I'm looking at the cases, I just don't see anything else I could grant besides what I'm voting to grant. At this point, David Strauss has to cover his ears because I'm going to switch from rigorous statistical analysis to reasoning by hypothesis and extrapolating from a sample of one. But I do want to tell an anecdote that I think illustrates the problem of cases slipping through the cracks. There was a cert petition filed in late 2006 in a case called Smith v. Wisconsin. The petition doesn't have my name on it, but it was done by the University of Virginia Supreme Court Litigation Clinic, which is run by a guy named Mark Stancil, who at the time was an associate in my firm and had come to my firm relatively recently, so I was looking over his shoulder a lot. So this wasn't my petition. It's not completely sour grapes on my part, but I was very familiar with the petition as it progressed. This petition was denied, obviously, but let me explain what it had going for it. The question was whether it was a Sixth Amendment violation to have an administrative assistant from the prosecutor's office, but who didn't work directly with the prosecutor on a jury in a criminal case. So the constitutional question was squarely presented. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin divided 4-3 on this question. The dissent was written by the Chief Justice of Wisconsin, Shirley Abrahamson, who is among state court judges particularly well-known and well-respected. So start with a very good dissent, closely divided Supreme Court of Wisconsin. Justice O'Connor had written a concurrence in a case called Smith v. Phillips, suggesting that the exact facts of Smith v. Wisconsin would be a constitutional violation. So you have some Supreme Court precedent suggesting that maybe the Supreme Court of Wisconsin got it wrong. Four other state Supreme Courts had come out the opposite way, the way the Abrahamson dissent suggested they should come out. And the kicker was the Seventh Circuit had come out the other way. Now, the Seventh Circuit is the court with habeas jurisdiction over cases coming from Wisconsin. So you had the most intolerable kind of circuit conflict, which is a state Supreme Court saying something doesn't violate the Constitution, the Federal Court of Appeals with jurisdiction over habeas cases saying the same thing does violate the Constitution, and the possibility that the state Supreme Court would uphold convictions and then it would go into habeas and the Seventh Circuit would say, we have clearly established law contrary to what the state Supreme Court said, and a real mess. Now, am I shocked that Smith v. Wisconsin was denied? No. The theory of the pool, and this is part of the problem in my view, the theory of the pool is that it's never wrong to recommend a denial because anything that's really important will come up again later. Recurring important issues will always have a stream of cases coming up. You can always get to them later. Whereas the clerks are always told, if you recommend a grant and it's later dismissed as improvidently granted, you'll be marked for the rest of your life. So I'm not shocked that Smith v. Wisconsin was denied. Here's what shocks me, and here's what makes me think cases are coming through the crack, falling through the cracks. The state of Wisconsin waived response to the cert petition. With all of those things going for it, the state of Wisconsin didn't bother to respond, and not one justice, because it only takes one justice to call for a response, not one justice thought that they should ask the state of Wisconsin what it had to say about why it shouldn't grant this case. That tells me that no one paid enough attention. That tells me that the pool clerk probably buried the case somehow, and whoever looked at it in Justice Stevens' chambers missed it, just dropped the ball somehow. Now, exactly how the ball got dropped, I don't know. That's the internal workings of the court, which I can't analyze. But cases like Smith v. Wisconsin make me think that the real explanation for things like Sam Alito's remarks and for the objective decline in the docket is that cases are just falling through the cracks and that the pool is not necessarily serving the court very well.
Right. I'll just make one quick comment. It's very interesting. When I covered the court, I looked at every paid cert petition except the ones where there was a waiver of response. I didn't put the time in because I figured, you know, if the court was interested, they'd call for a response, and then I could put the time in to look at the petition. So it's kind of a, you know, the other side of that coin is very interesting.
Linda, before we switch to Lyle, let me make a plug for one article that I think is going to be fascinating to true Supreme Court nerds. In the January 2009 George Mason Law Review, there's an article by two Stanford students, David Thompson and Melanie Wachtel. They were Stanford students when they wrote it. They've moved on to better things since then. But it analyzes CFRs and calls for response and calls for the views of the Solicitor General, and it's the first comprehensive analysis of that data set, and it's very interesting.
Very interesting. Thanks. Lyle Denniston, Dean of the Supreme Court Press Corps. You've covered the court. Well, let me put it this way. When Justice Brennan retired in 1990, that left Lyle the longest-serving person at One First Street. So Lyle has a very interesting, previously undisclosed also, theory for what's happening.
By the way, in my first term of the court, when John Jay was the chief, we did have fewer grants than last term. I'm pushing a theory which needs a lot of testing, but for which there is almost no data. My theory on why the docket is down, and I embrace some of the others, is the process of what is called defensive denial. It is often possible in high-profile cases where the issue is very deeply controverted for there to be four votes to grant. But those four, whoever they are looking ahead to the merits and are anticipating that they will not be able to attract a fifth vote on the merits. And so they are not pressing their right under the rule of four to have the court grant cert and to go forward. The empirical basis for the theory is essentially my own research. Let me give you a statistical example. Last term, in addition to the cases that were actually granted, I prepared extensive case notes on 142 cert petitions. So that makes a total of cert petitions or jurisdictional statements of well over 200 that I prepared during the course of the term. It was very clear to me on the basis of the quality of the cert petition or the nature of the conflict or the nature of the substance at issue, that every one of those cases was worthy of the court's review. When I finally started shaking down those 142 in anticipation of today's conference, it became apparent to me that there are, within that 142, there are probably as many as 20, perhaps 30, in which I would make at least a hypothetical argument that the defensive denial process was working. There is another way of looking at this. Instead of there being a rule of four for grant cert, that in high profile cases where ideology is very likely to emerge in the course of deciding on the merits, there is functionally a rule of five. In my paper, which I invite you to read, and I further invite you to criticize if you would like to do so, because I'm just learning in this area. The prime example that I offer of a defensive denial was the court's decision in the 2007-2008 term in Boumediene versus Bush, the big constitutional habeas case out of Guantanamo. It is almost an unanswerable hypothesis that there were four votes to grant, that John Stevens split off from the four when he could not be sure that Tony Kennedy would join on the merits. So he and Kennedy wrote a separate statement when the court denied cert in February, articulating their desire to see this played out in the lower courts first through the Detainee Treatment Act process. The case, as you probably are well aware, ultimately was granted at the end of the term, and there wasn't a great deal of intervening activity in this area that would have persuaded the court to change its mind. So my own hypothesis is that John Stevens, who has in very many ways has assumed the mantle that Bill Brennan had of really trying to mask the court not only on the merits decisions but on its grant cycle, John Stevens has become a very active negotiator and manipulator, and I think he worked on Tony Kennedy between February and June and ultimately persuaded Kennedy to go with him. And as you know, the ultimate outcome was that Kennedy wrote for the majority in a sweeping decision establishing for the first time a constitutional right of habeas. There are other cases during this past term that I cite in my paper, and as I say, to me the hypothesis is quite convincing, but it could use some very rigorous testing. Thanks.
Thank you, Al. Richard Lazarus of Georgetown, founder of the Georgetown Supreme Court Institute, is not Edward Lazarus, with whom he is sometimes confused, but we know.
Much better looking.
We know that he's our Richard Lazarus from right here in Washington, D.C.
I want to focus on a different problem with the court's plenary docket, not the declining numbers. I'm not even necessarily persuaded that's a problem. Declining numbers alone doesn't tell me the court is not doing a better job than it did in the past in picking cases. What I do think is a potentially serious problem, though, is not the number of cases on the plenary docket, but the content. of the cases on the docket. More particularly, I think there is reason to believe that the court's plenary docket is being increasingly captured by what I refer to as the expert Supreme Court bar, which is itself dominated by members in the private sector bar who represent powerful economic interests. Of course, that is nothing more than an application of the sort of well-settled theory of agency capture. The only difference is that I'm applying to the Supreme Court and not a regulatory agency. But I see no reason to believe that the court is immune from that possibility. The statistics, I think, are fairly striking. If you put aside the Solicitor General's office, the expert Supreme Court bar was responsible for 5.7% of the successful cert grants in October term 1980. By October term 2000, that number had jumped to 25%. By October term 2005, to 36%. By October term 2006, to 44%. By October term 2007, it topped 50% for the first time at 53.8%. And I crunched the numbers last night for October term 2008, it's higher still at 55%. Now, why do I think that's a problem? The Supreme Court of the United States is an extremely important governmental institution. It has limited time and limited resources. The public has every reason to expect that justices will expend the court's limited resources on the legal issues most important to the nation, and not those most important to those who can afford to pay the top dollars the private Supreme Court bar justifiably charges. But I worry that the latter and not the former what increasingly happened. The source of the problem, I think, is the structure of the court's decision-making process at the cert stage. The court is currently exceedingly vulnerable to its docket being captured in this manner because it doesn't allocate the resources necessary for its resistance. The court's power, and what makes the court so powerful, is it has the ability to choose which cases to hear. But that is also the court's greatest vulnerability. Under the current system, the law clerks play the dominant role, and they are, most simply put, I think, no match for the expert Supreme Court advocate. With the thousands of petitions they have to review, even with the cert pool process, they don't have the time, they don't have the experience to evaluate the arguments being made as quickly as they must make them. The advocates are pros at this. They know the justices, they know them personally, they know them professionally. They know how to pitch the cases, they spend days, months working on this. They know how to frame them. They know how to garner amicus support, which sends a ready signal to the clerks of importance. And many of these attorneys are nothing short of celebrities for the clerks. Many of them actually hope to work for those same law firms right after they finish clerking. The experts also, I think, hurt people who lack that and clients who lack that kind of expertise, because the experts raise the bar of what the clerks expect to see for a case to be cert-worthy. That's what the clerks expect, and other clients, including important cases, can't match that kind of showing. Nor do I think this capture is simply a reflection of a pro-business court. In other words, just a non-hostile takeover. Justices are, at the end of the day, they're the ones who vote whether to grant review or not. But the justices under the current structure are highly dependent on their clerks at the jurisdictional stage and who the clerks are. I think it's a mistake to overestimate the justices, and I think it's a mistake for the justices to overestimate themselves. The answer to the problem, I think, can be found also in agency capture theory. To reduce the risk of agency capture, Congress reformed agency decision-making structures to minimize that possible influence. I think to reduce the risk of docket capture, the Supreme Court should seriously consider reforming its own decision-making structure at the jurisdictional stage. I'm not saying Congress should do it. To be sure, I think it's helpful also to spread the expertise around to those who are not representing just economic interests. I think that happens. It happens naturally. The law firms do a lot of pro bono clinics, and obviously the Supreme Court clinics and a lot of law schools are trying to pick up some of that. But pro bono has its limits, and the firms won't do it in a case which clashes with their clients, those same interests. And the clinics, most of them are run by the same law firms, but the clinics, after all, whether it's a Yale law student, a Harvard law student, or a Stanford law student, Yale, Harvard, and Stanford, and the others, Texas, Virginia, they're all fabulous law schools. But Yale law students and Stanford law students are, at the end of the day, just that. They're students, and they're no match for the Supreme Court bar. The problem is not just with the bar, but the problem is at the court, and I think the court should strive to fix it.
Very interesting. Thank you, Richard. Lee Epstein is a political scientist as well as a law professor at Northwestern and one of the leading empiricist students of the court and its work, and she's going to maybe cast a cloud over all this theorizing.
Thank you. I don't know if you can see this graph in the back. This is like the lowest tech presentation ever.
It's like a human PowerPoint.
What it shows is the fraction of decisions of the Supreme Court with a dissent. And the only thing you have to see is sort of this really abrupt increase here. It kind of presents something of a mystery, you know, why the demise in consensual norms on the U.S. Supreme Court happened in like the 30s, early 40s. And to me, the prime answer to this kind of mystery, and probably to many of you, would be in the 1925 Judiciary Act, in which the court's docket sort of went from one of obligation to one of discretion. Cases get harder, closer, more dissents, right? So this seemed quite obvious to me, and I did use some statistics stuck in the 1925 Judiciary Act. Voila, it explained this big increase. Had a great story. Cause, effect, done with the project. And somebody commented to me, well, you know, have you considered the fact that during this period, the 30s and the 40s, there was very high turnover on the Supreme Court? Maybe that actually explains the dissent, a disruption of norms on the court. And I said, all right, you know, I can think about that. And I stuck that in the statistical model, and it turned out that worked too. You know, that explained this. Then somebody else came along and said, well, you know, did you consider the fact that the new judges, justices coming on in the 30s and 40s were very young, right? And they really didn't understand the norms of the court. I said, all right, yeah, I'll do that. Put that in the model. Great, that explains the rise too. I could go on, but you see the point. This change is so abrupt that anything you stick in there that also trends up or down is going to explain that increase. You could put in, you know, the price of wine, California wine. It's going to explain that. You could put in temperature of the earth, and it's going to explain that increase, right? And you could come up with some story. You know, people are hotter, angrier, they dissent more, whatever. So you have a very similar problem that we're all focusing on today, with the decline of the decisions or work output coming from the Supreme Court. It's not as abrupt, again, human PowerPoint, but this is the number of decisions the court is handing down, and you see that sort of downward trend everybody's talking about. And it's the same problem. Anything you put in a model or anything you theorize about that also trends is going to pick that up. And so that could be the number of justices in the cert pool. It could be the increasing homogeneity of the circuits leading to less splits. It could be the increasing expertise of attorneys. It could be the decline in the Solicitor General cert petitions. It's all going to pick that up. So what do you do when you're confronted with this kind of situation? My own view is I think the Yale Law students in their project are exactly on the right track. What they've done is they've lined up like 15 sort of explanations for why we see this decline. What the next step would be is, it's a similar thing that I did with the dissent project, is to come up with sort of clever ways to test each of those hypotheses that don't run you down this trend problem, in which case you'll never be able to establish cause and effect. So the idea would be for each of the explanations offered here and for each of the explanations offered by the students to come up with kind of clever, as I'm saying, sort of clever tests of those hypotheses. Let me just provide one quick example. I'll use Lyle's paper, which is a defensive denial story. I think the basic story, and Lyle, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is a story about uncertainty, right? So the four justices on either side are uncertain that they're going to be able to pick up the fifth vote, so they vote to deny cert. I think one way to test that would be to look at other periods where we've had very strong middle median justices who probably add to that uncertainty, like we do now. And one might go back to, say, the 1950s when we had Tom Clark, who was a very strong middle justice, and see if you see the same sorts of patterns. But that's kind of the idea of setting up tests that don't rely on this trends that we see.
Thanks, Lee. Well, I want to get some conversation going on the panel, but I will start off with an anecdote that I remember from back around the time when the decline in the docket was first becoming noticeable, and the Chief Justice sponsored a little party. Lyle, you remember, it's the one where he came out with the Indian War bonnet.
Yes.
And we started asking him about the decline in the docket, and he said, well, you know, Marx and Engels predicted the withering away of the state, and maybe the state is withering away starting with the Supreme Court. So, you know, they're possibly an element of will, or to put it another way, maybe what the cert pool story suggests is the evolution of a new cultural norm in this period, led by perhaps a new Chief Justice who, having lived through as an Associate Justice the complete chaos of every June under the Burger Court, where you know, they could barely get through the day, and there were every term ended with a couple of cases being set over for re-argument for the simple reason they couldn't get around to finishing them, and so on, and you know, made a judgment that we've got to get kind of a handle on that. So that's just, you know, an observation from an anecdote. Roy, let me ask you, in your interaction with Justice Alito, who, as people may know, has decided, after having joined the cert pool when he first came on the court, he's now dropped out of the cert pool. Has he ever discussed that or said why he's chosen to leave the cert pool?
I'm not aware of any public discussion. He did say in these remarks in 2007 that if he ever found the time, he would like his chambers to do a study for cases they might have missed and see if in fact he was wrong in thinking that they weren't missing anything they should pick up. I don't know whether that any kind of study was ever done. I don't know how rigorous it was. Obviously, the law clerks would have done the grunt work if the study ever happened, but you could imagine him turning to his incoming clerks in the summer of 2007 and saying, hey, I've been giving stump speeches about this. Now, before we get into action, why don't you take a look at this and go through last term's cert petitions and see if there were any we missed. And he may have concluded, as I do, that they are missing a lot of things. But I'm speculating. None of that's anything Alito said except that something he would like to do someday.
Right. I guess, or at least from what I've heard, Justice Sotomayor has joined the cert pool but said that that's open to reconsideration. Is that right, Lyle?
That's my impression that she has done so. By the way,
Lyle, I think you have to talk into the mic.
Oh, I'm sorry. Justice Breyer has said privately the same thing that Roy is attributing to Justice Alito, that in fact had said to some of us that he was really surprised to hear the argument which reporters make to him every year when we meet him for lunch, that there were interesting cases that they were not granting. And he said he actually intended to make a study, I don't know whether or not that's gone forward, of the proposition that there were cases, in fact, that they were missing. Justice Alito has said to me, Justice Scalia has said to me the same thing that Sam Alito has said, which is there's just not that much interesting coming to us out there. So,
just one thing. I mean, one easy way to try to do that experiment is maybe to do what Alito is doing, and that is you leave the cert pool. You still use the cert pool memos because you're still going to get them. And then you free your clerks up because they're not doing the cert pool. You free your clerks up to spend time looking at other cases and trying to see whether they can miss. So it's one way to start to try to go down that path is to abandon the cert pool and give your clerks some time to do an independent look and see if the cert pool is missing things and whether you're finding other things.
The observation that we just don't have enough good cases, I don't think is ideologically inflected, because I've heard a number of justices across the spectrum say that. And in fact, I've never heard a justice in, you know, recent years say, you know, we're denying cases that I really think mm-hmm. ought to be granted.
Well, Linda, by the same token, the hypothesis that the court is just trying to get smaller, that it's against big government, I think doesn't pan out, because one of the closest things on this court to a big government liberal is Justice Ginsburg, and she's more stingy in her cert votes than almost anybody else.
One thing that might bear watching for, you know, people who are interested in further research on this, I noticed in the last term a resurgence of the published dissent from denial, which was a practice that was pretty common back in the Berger years. And I mean not just the noting of dissent, as Justices Brennan and Marshall did when they noted their dissent from every capital case in the belief that capital punishment was always cruel and unusual, or Justice White kind of reflexively noting dissent from denial of any circuit conflict, but published dissents that really kind of tee up the issue and invite people to keep bringing that issue to the court. That had really fallen away, I think, under the Chief Justiceship of Chief Justice Rehnquist. And when Chief Justice Roberts pretty much started last term with that film noir parody of a search case, which he publishes dissent from denial, I thought maybe that was a signal of some kind that it was time to revive that practice. And I don't know whether anybody might have kind of made the same sort of observation or whether that might be something that bears watching. Let me just invite the panelists to respond to anything that they've heard, and then we have a few minutes to open it up to the audience.
Linda, one quick point on the whether there's enough grantable cases, so to speak. You know, all of the justices, while saying that there's not enough grantable cases, have also mentioned that it's a highly subjective inquiry, that it's a lot about personal feel. I mean, Justice Harlan mentioned that, Chief Justice Rehnquist mentioned that. And what I find really shocking, particularly about the data, is Justice White in particular, I talked about his high grant rate, he had a policy of voting to grant or at least join three in every case in which there was a split. And that doesn't account for all of his votes, but I think that accounts for a large part of the differential. Lyle's point, I think, really hit home, which is he found 140 cases or so last term that were grantable. So I think there are some cases that are falling through the crack. And I know other people, Arthur Hellman and some other scholars, have noted that there are a lot of cases with splits that are just not getting through for whatever reason, whether it's a cert pool or a different philosophy for the justices who currently sit on the court as to what is cert worthy.
David, I noticed in your data that Justice Scalia's rate of voting to grant plummeted also. And I wonder if you have any kind of theory about that.
I do. Well, it's actually the starkest ones were Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas voted to grant, and I don't have the number sitting in front of me, but around 110 times during the 91 term, I think. And that dipped down to being the lowest member of the court to grant in 93, I think 40 sometimes, 49 times. Chief Justice Rehnquist, we saw a similar phenomenon. It's hard, what that indicates to me is one of two things. One is that the justices, because of the rapid turnover perhaps, were unsure where their colleagues were going to come out, and thus were less likely to be aggressive in granting because of all the rapid turnover. And that was on the heels of Casey and some other very controversial decisions. The other thing it suggests, and getting back to Lee's point, is there are other things operating here. In other words, we're seeing a general decline among all of the justices, including the ones that were sitting. Now, the decline is much greater, or the differential is much greater for the new members of the court, but there certainly are other factors operating that need to be empirically tested.
I would only add that what David just said is important, because you have to, I think, contextualize David's data to the current court. If you look, for example, at the 1982 term, which is a very conservative term on the Supreme Court, Brennan and Marshall voted to grant cert in almost like zero cases. Now, they would have been very happy if the court had not done any business that term, I think. And so I think you're getting at something important here, David, when you talk about your data in a period of uncertainty on both sides of the court.
Linda, can I just a slight dissent to this stuff. I agree with everyone. I think the court is missing significant cases, which part of my pitch was from a different direction. But I also think the court, in some respects, is doing a better job than it did. When I was in the SG's office with Charles and Andy and Tom and Roy in the sort of late 80s, they took 160 cases a year. A lot of those cases just weren't cert-worthy. I mean, they were really, you look at them and you think, why in the world is the court bothering to decide a lot of these issues? They had their docket cluttered with a lot of stuff which wasn't necessarily so important. And you would shake your head, we'd do it, because it gave us more chances to argue before the court. So that was great. But I think the court has gotten rid of some of the bad cases. So I think some of the decline may be not a decline, but a rise in selectivity. I don't think it's all negative. I think part of it may be positive.
Well, but how many times in the term and how many terms must the court grant more than one case on how you define the one-year filing deadline for federal habeas? I mean, it strikes me that we have answered that question from every direction in which you can approach it.
Right, so it could decline even more.
It could decline even more.
I agree.
Lynn, I think another factor that again, it's a question of whether the data will support this if you quantify it. John Stevens is the only member of the court who was around when the court was deciding 150 and 160 cases a term. And I am not sure that any of the others who liked the workload process they have now is aware of how difficult it is to go beyond maybe 50 or 60 or 70 cases a year, and don't want to anticipate that difficulty. And I can remember, by the way, a time when the court also had a summary docket. Not every case granted was given a plenary review. The court disposed of a lot of cases with summary disposition, and that's one alternative that perhaps could be thought about to bring it back for cases like the one-year filing deadline for federal habeas. But I do think that there is a habit among the more recent justices of just not wanting to do more. And I think contributing to that is the degree of public activity of the present justices. If you're going to teach a summer seminar at Salzburg, as Tony Kennedy does every year, if you're going to do multiple TV appearances, as Scalia and Breyer do, that takes a little time. And I think the justices very much like not having to work that hard. It's probably in the memory of a lot of other people. I remember when there was a very active campaign within the justices to create, or at least to consider creating, an intermediate court between the federal circuits.
It was kind of led by Warren
Supreme
Berger,
court.
As I recall.
Yes, I mean, the idea to have a filtering court that would make your cert selection for you because there was just too damn much work to do. That idea obviously has not been revived and certainly doesn't need to be revived if the court only works one day a week or maybe 2 days a week or certainly only 1 hour a week. Last March, for example, there were 4 days during the 6 days of sitting in which the court only heard one case. That's not heavy lifting, as John Stevens once remarked to me.
Right. Richard, let me just ask you one question that I do want to save some time. But your study of the role of the Supreme Court bar, and I know you've published on this, the rising proportion of the docket. So has the Supreme Court bar numerically grown as exponentially as its success rate would indicate?
Yeah, it's one of these great, wonderful paradoxes, which is at the precise time that the docket halved, the bar expanded, and supply and demand in reverse. And part of that, I think, is because their expertise became more valuable as the court became more selective and harder to do. Then it became more important to get an expert who could get that scarce resource. And so we've seen in the last, basically, you can dock it almost exactly the same time, the same month that Rehnquist becomes Chief Justice, September 86. Rex Lee starts basically at Sidley and Austin, and he proved it could be done. He proved he could get access to that docket, and then a lot of the other firms have created practices since. It's a shrinking pie for an increasing supply, and there's a lot of competition, but that's one reason they're more and more successful.
Okay. Let me turn it up to the audience. Tom.
Just a small data point, bears on this personnel change hypothesis. 1986, which is when it starts, there were two changes. Rehnquist became Chief Justice and Scalia joins the court. And I once went back to look to see, you know, what those two had to say about the size of the docket around that time period. 1 year before he becomes Chief Justice, Justice Rehnquist gives a speech in which he endorses the National Court of Appeals because he is convinced that the overwhelmingly large Supreme Court docket can't be handled by the court and it's necessary to go along with further creation of the Court of Appeals. That suggests that he knows sort of hardwired, you know, hostility toward the size of the docket on the part of Justice Rehnquist. Toward the end of his first
term, I think Jen is standing there with a mic for you.
Oh, sorry. You're doing a good job on your own.
Toward the end of his first year on the court, Justice Scalia gives a speech, I believe it was at Georgetown, in which one of the things he says, I believe in response to a question, but this was published in some legal newspaper, that he thinks the court is taking way too many cases and that they can't write careful enough opinions given the number of cases that they're taking. So one thing we know about Justice Scalia is he's a very persuasive advocate for his views. And it could be that if he joined the court and then fairly quickly concluded that the docket should be smaller, that he proselytized for that view internally, the law clerks, the little sheeps that they are, on the cert pool would pick up on this and took the new signal to be that a new standard had to be adopted.
Can I do a quick follow-up to what Tom said? If you look, I never heard that, Tom. If you look to the 86 term, which is Scalia's first term, if you look at his opinions as they came out that term, he was really slow. His opinions tend to come more out at the end than the beginning. He was very, very slow. And Rehnquist looked like he started to zero out him for assignments towards the end. So that may be why he was complaining. He wasn't keeping up the pace at the beginning.
That all makes a lot of sense, except the declining docket has continued since John Roberts became Chief Justice. And in his confirmation hearings, he said he thought there was room for more cases on the Supreme Court's docket. He had the same bias that I disclosed for myself earlier, which is he'd been in private practice filing petitions, getting them denied sometimes, having to explain them to clients. So one would have expected, and he's a pretty persuasive guy too, one would have expected some, at least temporary, jump when John Roberts joined the court, but it didn't happen.
Alan Morrison.
What about the fact that the conferences are much shorter? We know that the long conference in September, which used to run on for a day and a half, is now done in the morning since Rehnquist took over. I understand that the regular weekly conferences are done in an hour or less. It's hard to get data on that, and that, it's hard to know whether that's a cause or an effect, but it certainly seems to be, I think, probably true, but although I don't think anybody has any hard data on it, except maybe the clerk, it's unlikely to get that available.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think that goes to the internal norms of communication within the court where, you know, in the Berger years, they could just sort of run on. And when Rehnquist became Chief Justice, he said, you know, your second thought is rarely any better than your first thought, and so we're just going to stick to your first thought, and we're going to break for lunch and not come back.
But, Alan, another response to that is that the length of the conference, I think, is primarily determined by the length of the discuss list. Mm-hmm. And the discuss list has shrunk, I think, primarily as a consequence of the cert pool. On this, I think Roy's point is the most compelling. The discuss list, so far as we know about it, is very, very selective anymore. And I think that's more attributable to the clerks than anywhere else.
Yeah, and just having eyeballed the discuss list, I've spent a ton of time in the Blackmun papers, and having eyeballed these discuss lists, it appears that the discuss list did get smaller during this period as time went on. So by 93, there were fewer. Now, I haven't run any kind of statistical analysis on it, but just eyeballing it, it looked like the discuss list, particularly the summer discuss list, became much smaller.
Well, it also was true that the Chief Justice, when Rehnquist was the Chief, actively discouraged discussion at the conference. I mean, Scalia has complained in a number of venues about being told by the Chief Justice that look, we will have plenty of time after we assign the opinions to discuss this among ourselves. Let's keep it short today. So,
just to clarify for the few people in the room who maybe don't know, so the default mode of handling cert petitions is that everything is denied unless it's put on the discuss list and actually discussed at conference. So the discuss list, which is not made public, the conference list is circulated, but the discuss list is not made public, is really the key step Because if you're not on the discuss list, you're denied before you wake up in the morning.
But Linda, it only takes one justice to put it on a discuss list. Right. So
let's take one question down here, and then I think we're out of time.
Elaine Middleman, I was wondering if the recent re-argument in Citizens United, you know, maybe the court just made up its own cert petition when they redefined the question.
I think Citizens United is almost sui generis. The court does not like to close a term without deciding every case that was argued during that term. I don't think there's any indication in the grant, the assignment of an additional question in Citizens United that the court wants to do that with any great regularity. In fact, the argument was scheduled in September precisely so that the court could count it as an 08 term case, for even if they don't decide it until June of 2010.
Okay, let me thank the panel, and I guess we'll reassemble. Next panel is 10:20.